Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Hi, listeners. This is Jason. I am delighted to have you all listening today on the Fundraising Podcast. I've got a lineup here today that I'm very excited to introduce you to. We have had a heck of a time trying to get the three of us on here to have this conversation. I think this is maybe try number three. I think the last two attempts were my fault. So I'm very grateful to David and Rebecca for both being patient with me. But David, you spurred some curiosity on my part with a recent article, so we're going to talk about that. I think that's what we're going to talk about. And Rebecca, I knew that you could play counterpoint on some of the ideas that David's going to share with us. And I'm just going to sort of sit back and enjoy the conversation. I might hop on my pedestal at about 30 minutes in. But as all of you know, all my listeners know, we like to have a meaningful conversation without prepping a whole lot. But before we do that, how about we just let our guests introduce themselves? Rebecca, we'll start with you.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's great to be here today. I have been working in the field of fundraising for a very long time, as you can tell by my gray hair. And I have a background in higher education. So a lot of my work has been with colleges. I was a vice president for advancement at a college. And then I was also the head of the Foundation for Independent Colleges of Pennsylvania for a short time when I learned that I don't like corporate fundraising. But that's another whole podcast and story. So I have been consulting on my own for about 25 years. But one of my major clients during that whole time is an organization called InTrust, or the InTrust Center for Theological Schools, which gives you a sense of that clientele. So that combines my interest in faith-based fundraising. So almost all of the organizations that I work with are faith-based. I also do a lot of work with boards because over the years, I've learned that you can't talk about fundraising in a nonprofit sector without talking about the board, and you can't talk with boards without talking about fundraising. So I thought, might as well put those two together and do it all under one title. So that's me. I've been doing this work for about 30 years.
Rebecca, it is very difficult. And I don't say this just to, I say this with all sincerity and honesty. It is very difficult for me to be working with a client where I do not reference Growing Givers Hearts and recommend that they, because it was probably one of the first books that I read, one of the first thick books that I read, subtitled Fundraising as a Ministry. Seeing, you know, discovering fundraising as a ministry is something that I think so many of us, both in the faith-based space, but also in the secular sense. I think there's a lot of applicability to what you wrote. and what I've continued, and I've recommended that book, bought that book for my clients, that sort of stuff. So I'm delighted to have you on here. David, you have been a guest on the podcast. I think you get the reward of having been invited back in the shortest time period between your previous episode. I don't even think it's been 50 episodes. So that's kudos.
Happy to be
you.
Back.
Yes, I'm delighted. I think it was just back in the spring that we had you, and that was a really robust, meaningful conversation. So I'm glad to have you back. Tell us who you are.
Well, so like Rebecca, I've got about 30 years in higher education, and a lot of it was spent in fundraising. I was a college vice president for advancement. I've been in church-related higher education most of my career, and I've also served as a college president. Most recently, I had the privilege of working with Rebecca. She was my trustee at Lancaster Theological Seminary while I was serving there as interim president. And through that connection, I've started working with InTrust with Rebecca as my director through the Y Stewards Initiative with theological schools working on governance issues as a governance coach. And then I also work as the practice lead for private higher education foundations for the Association of Governing Boards consulting arm. And where we, as Rebecca said, I think the transformational impact of higher education or the institutions that we serve through this ministry of fundraising really is at its heart a governance question as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much.
So, David, we like to come with a big idea, bold opinion. You wrote an article a couple of weeks ago. So you're both very invested in higher education. And I posted on so my classes over at the at your college started last night. And I posted on my way back to the house after before I left the school. I have now spent 6 semesters teaching. I teach their social entrepreneurship class, their nonprofit management course, and now their small business. It's the most meaningful work I've ever done. I've got to tell, I mean, I love fundraising, but teaching is just remarkable work. And being in a classroom with 20 students, I was delighted to be back in the classroom. It's just very meaningful work. So I was very eager to have this conversation because I'm invested both professionally and somewhat quasi-personally. I've got my kids in college right now. So David, you had some big ideas to say about where education was going in sort of this post-pandemic sort of world, what the financial outlook was going to be. So why don't you tee up our conversations there? And then I'm just going to let you guys pass the ball back and forth.
Yeah, I know you have a lot of listeners, Jason, who aren't necessarily on the rhythm of higher education. So let me just set the frame here that most colleges and universities have a July 1 to June 30 fiscal year. That might vary by a yes. month or two either way. And so when we talk about the new year, we're talking about this time of year for colleges and universities as we begin the fall semester. And most colleges and universities have come off one of the most unusual years, just as the world has come off of an unusual year. And one of the places that that's really impacted was fundraising. A lot of the things that you talk about, Jason, and Rebecca talks about, both in terms of being responsive and relational, have been impeded by the restrictions that we've observed during the pandemic for public health reasons. And so a lot of the tools in our toolkit that we've used in the past to develop strong relationships with donors have really caused us to have to innovate and improvise over the course of the last year. And so I think a lot of schools saw mixed fundraising results. I think some schools had surprisingly large fundraising success last year, and other schools really saw some diminishment in their charitable giving over the course of the last year. I think the same is true on the budgetary front, that a lot of schools did better than they thought they were going to do last year with revenues and expenses, and some did worse. Those who did better often will credit the federal grants that they received and maybe controlling costs below what the federal grants were. But that's put colleges and universities in an odd situation as we go into the new year, because to gain students last year, a lot of schools discounted more heavily and also might have reduced occupancy on campus. And so regaining the revenue streams that colleges and universities need for the new year is really strained. And now Delta is throwing a new curveball at colleges and universities too. And so both Rebecca and I have been at that cabinet table when the traditional revenues are added up and the traditional expenses are added up and the room gets kind of quiet. And then all of a sudden, everybody kind of turns to the advancement VP. And the advancement VP has this, you know, has sweated over this goal for the year that they felt like they could actually bring in. And but the only thing, the only lever that an institution has to pull pretty much is the development lever. And, you know, so is there anything more that we can do to raise more money in the new year? And so the article that I wrote that you were referencing was really talking to boards and presidents about what you could realistically expect from development this year. And the three things that I suggested were, you know, renewal, re-engagement, and raising the bar. And the main topics were, you know, with renewal, I think we really need to focus on stewardship and connecting those donors who did hang with us during the pandemic and make sure that they understand how appreciative we are and make sure that we don't lose them. Re-engagement is to find those donors that were with us right up until the pandemic. We lost them last year, perhaps for understandable reasons, but if we lose them again this year, pretty much we're going to have to start all over with year three. And the third area was raising the bar, and that is don't be unduly pessimistic based on whatever you had happened last year, and don't be unduly optimistic if you had a really surprisingly good year. Still, you know, stick to your guns in terms of projecting what the fundraising results should be for this next year. And I would maybe err on the side of optimism if you had to pick between the two, just because of where a lot of our asset donors are right now. But Rebecca, I'm curious, you know, what you think about those three things, how you would modify them or add to them.
Well, when I read the article, it really resonated with me. And I mean, one of the things that I was worried about was that that organizations, particularly in higher education, could become complacent because of the government money and, you know, step back and go, oh, you know, we're doing just fine, rather than looking at it as a blessing that can be used to give time to step back a little bit, or not step back, but take the time to really see what's going on with donors, listen to their stories, hear how they came through the pandemic. Where are they at in their own businesses, their own jobs, their, you know, their own investments and all of that, rather than, you know, having to hit really hard right away at the beginning of the new year. And so I like that idea of, you know, renewing relationships and letting people know, we know it's been tough for everyone, so we're not going to talk just about ourselves right now. Or use really touching stories, and there's a lot of them, of what families are saying as they bring their students, or in theological education, or and really in any of the nonprofits, to hear what are the stories that donors are telling about their own experience during this time, and then to connect in that way. So I really like that. I think it also gives us a little bit of a breather to maybe plan a bit more for this year. Because I don't know about you, but what I saw late in the last fiscal year were a lot of just weariness.
Yes.
On the part of, and I know development staff are always kind of weary at the end of the fiscal year and that hard push. But this was a different kind of weariness because we all had to learn new technologies. We all had to try to, you know, do our work in different ways, and which was good because I think it disrupted some of our not so functional ways of doing things that probably needed to be thrown on the scrap heap, but we just kind of kept doing them. But it also it was an added layer to the work. So I saw a lot of just really tired people. So maybe if we can start the new year focusing more on relationships and at least in my experience with fundraisers, what feeds our souls are and feeds our enthusiasm and gives us energy and life is talking with generous people about, and that's at any level, anyone who's generous, to hear what kept you going during this time. What gifts gave you the most joy over the last year? And did we contribute to that? Did our way of saying thank you contribute to that? And if not, I apologize. Mm. And we promise to do better this year. And thank you for telling us. So just having a little, maybe a little flex in this first half. And here again, I'm kind of thinking more higher education, a little more flex in this first half of the year, not backing off. There's an intention in these conversations, but so well, I really like.
That's interesting. You know, I pick up on your point of, you know, mutual renewal, that those who are working in the profession as well as the donors themselves are in need of renewal. And I think, you know, even though this is the beginning of the year for higher education, I think it's we're all in the same season relative to the pandemic, and that weariness that you spoke of, I think, is affecting all of us. I wonder, you know, so I've heard you talk before, Rebecca, about approaching fundraising and giving from a perspective of abundance rather than a perspective of scarcity. And I wonder how much that weariness is related to us feeling and maybe getting absorbed by a sense of scarcity in the last year when our tools were taken away from us, we're limited to two-dimensional screens, and how do we add that third dimension, that sense of abundance back in, maybe as we go into this new year?
Well, yeah, that's a great one, because I have been, again, fascinated. And I think the fun thing about being a consultant is we're not really the ones doing the asking in most cases. And so we can just observe. And I have seen some fundraisers and some organizations that just embraced the technology. You know, even, and I'll give a shout out for Lancaster Theological Seminary, which we both have been involved with, you know, discovering how events that were campus-based.
Right.
Basically meant a little tiny segment of the constituency could actually participate. When we took the alumni day.
Right.
Online, all of a sudden, people were checking in from all around the world. Mm. Well, there we went from scarcity that we can't even do this to, oh my gosh, look at all these people and look how excited they were. Now, I would love to know, I would love to track the alumni giving to that, you know, and see did that have an impact on alumni giving? Maybe 1 year wasn't enough. But I think we learn some things through that, which is another form of abundance. Every time you learn something new, that's abundance. When I say, oh, I've come to the end of my learning, I have nothing more to learn. Well, you know, then I'm starting to die. And so, you know, that was just one example. And I looked around and I began to see people who were being really creative and joyful in the use of technology and in new ways. Others were sitting there pouting because they couldn't do their golf tournament, you know, or because it's really hard to do a golf tournament on Zoom. And although I suppose there's somebody out there who found a way to do it. But if you're sitting there pouting and saying, oh man, you know, now I can't, and using the pandemic as an excuse for not being able to either pick up the phone or schedule a Zoom call with someone or think more creatively about an event, you know. So, yeah, I mean, abundance isn't just about what we have in our hands. It's about, I think, our whole way of looking at the world and at life and at possibilities. And it just has made a world of difference. I'll tell one more and then I'll go back.
No, that's great.
There's this wonderful ministry that was started here in my little town of Dillsburg, Pennsylvania, called New Hope Ministries. It was started by a group of six congregations. My home congregation is one of those. Well, New Hope is just blossoming. And I mean, they're starting, I think now it's up to 11 or 12 sites around the area. They added two during the pandemic. And people were just giving. But I'll tell you one thing, New Hope says thank you like nobody I've ever seen. Hmm. They are, well, and some would say, well, sure, it's easy for them to say thank you because their work is a very visual kind of work. A lot of what they do isn't all that visual, and it's very private, but they use the visual parts to tell their stories really well. It's still a lot of work, you know, and so that's my shout out to New Hope today, too. But anybody can do what they're doing. It's realizing that I have an abundance of stories. I have an abundance of generous people. We have an abundance of opportunities. Let's bring all those together. So
I think that's a great perspective for fundraisers to be thinking about this year. Even if you just think about your donor pool as, you know, look at it from a perspective of abundance as opposed to if you lost some over the last year, a perspective of scarcity. And I wonder how that might influence the way that we think about reengaging those that we lost. What I'm taking from your vignettes and your advice, Rebecca, is that maybe we should think about reengaging donors with story as well. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, with the renewal piece where we're doing stewardship, I think it's easier to figure out how to get into storytelling about what difference they made during the pandemic. But it sounds to me like we might need to listen a little bit more this year than normal to those that we've lost. And instead of coaxing or cajoling, we might just want to sit back and try to understand and comprehend what they've been through and where they are, because they might need to make that journey from scarcity to abundance or remake that journey again in their lives. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I think if we really do need to listen very carefully to what people are saying, because there are a lot of people who have been terribly hurt by the pandemic. A lot of people who are grieving real loss of family members, friends, but also grieving losses of high school graduations and all of that.
Right.
You know, so there's plenty of grief, and so also to recognize that we weep with those who weep and we celebrate with those who celebrate. So I think that weeping part or the grieving or the lamenting, which lamenting is a big word right now. Everybody's running around lamenting. But I don't think lamenting is a word of scarcity. I think lamenting is a word that recognizes that there will be abundance. There still is abundance, even if I don't particularly feel it right at this moment. I can have that hope. But as we listen to personal stories, I think for fundraisers to have the room and the permission to take time to grieve with someone and not to push them at a particular moment. And that's the art of fundraising. And you know, some people would say, well, it's reading the room, you know, it's emotional intelligence. It's those things. But I think when faith is in the mix, when God is in the mix, and that's, Jason, when you talk about the pastoral, it's knowing this is somebody who just needs somebody to sit here, cry with them maybe, and I'm really good at that. It doesn't take much for me to start crying. But also to pray with them and then say, I'll be back. Mm. I'll be back, but in the meantime, would you mind if I tell you some stories along the way that I think will maybe help even heal the pain that you're feeling right now. And just woo them back in with the right stories. But then when they come back, they're a story, because they can tell their own story about how maybe giving again helped them move beyond what they were lamenting.
They're giving from a different place.
Yeah, yeah. So, and those are the stories that I'm going to be listening for, I think, in this new year. So for fundraisers, and I hope we hear from some other people about, help us know, how do we listen for those stories, and what is sort of the appropriate venue or way to tell those stories without embarrassing someone, or, you know. But I think all of us will be deeply encouraged in our own lives as we hear how God can heal through generosity, and God can return joy into our lives through generosity.
I love what you said about giving the fundraisers permission to, and the room to grieve with the donors. And as you talk, Rebecca, you know, I'm reminded that both you and Jason, I think, for a long time have been calling for a paradigm shift in fundraising and in philanthropy in general. And, you know, so maybe my biggest fear is that we'll revert back to our old tactics this year and not use this disruption that we've experienced as an opportunity to reform fundraising in the way that I think most fundraisers know at their heart is, you know, what it's really going to take. You know, you need that time, you need that space, you need that room to deepen those relationships, and where you engage the donor in a mutually transformational or transformative experience. And as you said, the donor can be changed and give from a different place if we engage them properly. But you know, if our tools come rushing back to us and we get back into the same annual fund cycle, the same event cycle, the same portfolio metrics, then we might feel different types of, feel the old pressures coming back in, and it might feel old, familiar and comfortable again. And what it requires us to do is to stay in that space of discomfort and newness for a while as we try these new techniques that the pandemic in some strange way is giving us permission to fully engage and to really get in there and be relational in our connections with our donors and our other constituents. And so I think this is an opportunity, like few others I've seen in my career, to change not just the tactics, but make a strategic and paradigm shifting change in the way that we approach philanthropy altogether.
Yeah.
So if I think back on the last 100 conversations that we've had here on the podcast, all right in the midst of this pandemic, yeah, I'm talking to fundraising professionals, and I'm thinking about a lot of what you have just said, Rebecca, as it relates to abundance. But I'm also thinking about the last point, David, in your article about higher expectations. And when we think about one of the things that I recognize, so the first two fundraising roles I had in my career were at faith-based organizations. And there was an underlying assumption of abundance and availability, I guess you could say. There was just sort of this underlying assumption that there was more to be had. Opportunities were always there. But then as I transitioned into working for more what we would call secular institutions, organizations that were not raised in, sort of oriented in more of a faith-based tradition, I did notice some of that tired weariness and that lack of patience. One of you just used the word patience. Mm-hmm. And so getting back to the conversations that I've had with my guest in the last episode, for the last 100 episodes, I wonder if the two of you could talk to me about talk to us about how raising that expectation, I'm thinking about even the organization that, because it's an organization you and I, New Hope Ministries is very familiar to me too, as well, because you and I both live in the same area, Rebecca. But how does higher expectations and some of these higher aspirations that the fundraising community seems to want to have, like we have these higher aspirations that I'm basically thinking, okay, I've been listening to you all, but your aspirations are completely incompatible with the way in which you engage with your donors, right? Do you follow right. what I'm saying? I think that's kind of like the last conversation, Rebecca, you and I had at the breakfast table. Right. It's like, I understand you want these donors to really step up to the plate, and I understand you don't want it to be all about them, but you're going to have higher expectations of yourselves, and you're actually going to have higher expectations of your donors. You can't treat them like consumers. You can't just sort of sell them tchotchkes. You're going to actually have to lean into these relationships. You're going to have to be patient. You're going to have to unplug a couple galas and golf tournaments. Higher expectations and higher aspirations, sort of, don't they essentially work together?
Yeah. Well, that's a conversation I almost always have with boards.
Yeah.
Because, and here, you know, I'm speaking as a board member in a number of organizations, but you know, boards need to believe that there's a better way and that patience will pay off. And in fact, it will reap tremendous rewards. And that's, we don't do it for the rewards. Although it's my theological base is Anabaptism, and we're sort of a two kingdom people, but it always drives me crazy when we flip between the two, and all of a sudden we're talking about, you know, sort of over here. But anyway, I won't get into that either. But and I think board members and others can get real uncomfortable with the way I'm talking, because they see it as giving fundraisers permission to not really ask for money, to just kind of run around making people feel good. And
right.
And you go, no, you have a job. But what we do is we think carefully through everything we do with the eye to, am I moving that donor toward a different stage in their own life, and mm-hmm. and not for my organization. It's sort of parallel track. I want mm-hmm. them to fall deeper and deeper in love with whatever organization I'm representing. But if that's all that happens, I've failed. I also want them to be able to tell me, what is this giving doing in your own heart? And particularly because I always work in faith-based settings, what is God doing in your life? Or how is your relationship with God deepening? How are you becoming a more faithful follower of Jesus? Whatever the language is. And over the years, I've had to learn to be very multilingual in faith language. But however they're comfortable in talking about what is happening in their life of faith through their giving, if I don't hear that, then I've missed the mark. So it can be kind of confusing until you really spend the time talking, but it's a hard one for boards to grasp. Yeah. Because I've had board members say to me, I don't want that mushy stuff, or I don't want fundraising with a halo. I want somebody who can get out there, twist some arms, kick some butts, you know. And I go, well, if we have a bunch of broken armed donors who can't sit down, it hurts too bad. You know, they're going to go find someplace else to give, and that's, you know, that's not going to hold them. So, but it's a bigger upfront investment in the donors, and in our own strategies. Mm-hmm. But once it takes hold, and I would say New Hope is an example of what happens when it takes hold. Mm. You know, they're not an overnight wonder. They've been working at this for a long time. And you can point to, you know, lots of other organizations. But when it takes hold, you can't stop it.
You know, the word that comes to mind as you're talking, Rebecca, is dwell in the most positive sense of the term. Yeah. You know, it's how do you dwell with a donor and with a board and deepen that relationship? Then I have the same experience, you know, you do as a, you know, president or VP for advancement with boards, actually, you know, when it comes time for the campaign or to bring in more money, there it's always, isn't there somebody out there? And yeah. Well, yeah, the answer is always yes, maybe, probably, right? But we're not going to reach our goal unless we first take a hard look at the people who are in here. And we have to start with those folks who are closest to the institution already and aren't being introduced to the institution. And so there is merit to broadening the donor base. I don't ever want to take that away, but you have to remember that the breadth comes with some shallowness. And you know, if you're investing resources in broadening, you're probably spreading resources thin. If you're investing resources in deepening, you really are setting the institution or the organization up for longer term success. Which, you know, Jason, this reminds me of another point that you've addressed in your podcast before with, you know, fundraising professionals in general, kind of moving up the ladder by moving across institutions and that, or from organization to organization. And that's a great way to increase your salary and get a better business card, but it sure makes it tough to have those longer term relationships where you can actually deepen them. And so I think that puts the onus back on the institutions to find ways to have professional development for fundraisers that allows them professional growth over time. And it also, I think, you know, going back to the broken arms and the sore backsides, I think we need to think about what metrics it is that we're putting before our fundraisers and whether or not we're requiring them to go out and get more quickly as opposed to get a higher quality of gift and giving attitude over time.
Yeah. Because if we don't understand that, one, our organization is seldom the only thing the people who we call our donors care about. They're also several other organizations. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a competitive sense. I think we need to understand that in an appreciative sense. And in fact, I always, one of the things I want to know is, what else are you giving to? Not because I want to try to knock that other organization out of the equation, but I want to see, how can I create synergy then in the kinds of information I provide to that donor about the organization that I'm representing, so they can begin to see greater coherence in their overall giving. Because I think that's a part of their joy, is they begin to see that there are, for all of us, there are reasons why we're attracted to certain ministries or organizations, even if they don't on the surface seem alike, or that it might be harder for, if I can help them even begin to see that, I think they'll grow more generous to all of the organizations, because it becomes, and it helps them also, I think, to plan about where they're going to maybe increase one year and increase another year. And all of that is okay if I'm not just thinking about their mine and I'm going to get as much of their giving as I possibly can. And, you know, if I can maybe even say some bad things about that other organization, you know, little hints that my organization is better than that one. Those kind of games are just so destructive.
So I'm going to bring us back to the budget table, and all the president and all the vice presidents are staring at the VP for advancement right now. And so it seems to me that depending on how you managed last year, you might be in a different spot this year. So if you went for breadth and kind of approached it from a standpoint of scarcity, that you might actually be facing a tough year this year. But if you've got a head start on this deepening, this giving permission and room to develop and deepen relationships, you might actually be in a position to have a really good year this year when it comes to asking for gifts. And, you know, it's interesting when you think about this paradigm of scarcity or abundance, you know, that the budgetary question in the first instance is usually out of the sense of scarcity. Yeah. Yeah. And so the VP for advancement might have a ministry in that room, too, to help the institution begin to move from a sense of scarcity to a sense of abundance, and how we can see how there's so much more out there for us to grab hold of. Instead of making do, we can make more with what we have. So I think there may be a way to speak back into the budget process at the same time you go out and try to find those deepening relationships, as opposed to just trying to make the budget on the expense or on the backs of the donors.
Yeah. And I keep hoping that we're going to see more of the kind of collaboration and cooperation that all of the literature has been talking about for a long time, but particularly in higher education, but I think even across the whole of the nonprofit sector, it's really hard, or people have a hard time letting go of their sense of ownership and probably rightful pride in what they're doing, to say, maybe we can be the support to somebody else doing this. We can come alongside another organization. We don't have to start that. We don't have to, or maybe we even stop doing it. But, you know, so I'm going to be really curious to see if coming out of the pandemic, there's more of a willingness among organizational leaders, including boards, to understand that we don't have to do everything, which would mean then we don't have to push our individual donors quite as hard, because we may be funding more than what we should even rightfully be doing anymore. I don't know. That probably doesn't make a lot of sense.
We had a guest on here about probably not too long after you and I, David, talked in the spring. We had a guest on here that I had cited. There's a poet at Cambridge that works in the institutional space, I guess you could say. He David White is his name, and he said, "The conversation is the work." Mm. The conversation is the work.
Yeah.
And I cited that statement, White's statement, on the podcast, and that's what she's at. The woman that was my guest, she's at Virginia Tech, and the conversation just sort of simmered around that idea that the conversation is the work. It's the most popular podcast that we've had in the last 12 months.
Wow.
Both in terms of its just the summary itself on LinkedIn is remarkably positive, and then the number of downloads.
Now you're hurting my feelings.
Sorry. Virginia Tech's a pretty big school.
and you can't go wrong with David White.
But the thing about it is that I think that's kind of what you are both saying, is that you have to I have oftentimes said to my clients, because oftentimes you're making these advices to a board, for example, you're giving this advice and you're saying to them, sort of like to your notion, David, to sort of dwell And they're like, and then they almost want to like have a very, okay, fine, we'll dwell. And I almost say just dwell for six more months. So at the point at which, you're ready to solicit that five-figure, six-figure gift, just dwell with that relationship for six more months and see where it goes and teach yourself. And what I'm oftentimes doing is I'm trying to get, because I'm not an advocate for renewal rates, for example. I don't think relationships work. I don't go to my wife and say, hey, darling, we have not renewed our relationship this year. You know, there's a lot of other more truly human ways that my wife and I ensure that our relationship is quote-unquote renewed. And it's not using a 12-month calendar. And so I think some of what you both have said, you have to both believe in that abundance, which is what we sort of sat on for a long part of this conversation. But I just love the idea that we could line it up with the notion of dwelling in that relationship for another 6 months is believing that the abundance that you're about to ask for is there. Like, you know it's there, and you might even be able to close it, but you're also saying, I'm going to dwell in this relationship for six more months because I'm going to put the relationship ahead of closing this damn gift that I feel like I have to have right now, right? And so I'm just going to sit in it. And so I'm interested to know from both of you, because you both work in the higher ed space, how many of your boards do you think if we were all three of us consulting with board with the same board right now, how many boards out there could really lean into that? Or are they so, how many presidents and boards are so anxious to just start doing more that they can't sit in that six more months of meaningful relationships, meaningful conversations with their donors? And then I guess the other side of that same question, we'll wrap up on this thought. I'm very interested in your thoughts. Is how many fundraisers even know how to sit in that 6 months? I don't know that I know too many fundraisers who know when I say to them, just give it six more months. I know you can get $100,000 out of that gentleman. I know Mrs. Smith is ready to give you that gift, but give it six more months. I mean, how many of us are even ready for that?
Yeah, that's one of the things I think would be important. I think it's tough, to be honest with you, Jason. I think boards presidents or fundraisers are feeling the pressure and the urgency of the moment. And I think the key to, when you have a little bit, when boards actually take time to dwell, even in a retreat, a day and a half retreat, when they can spend more time on a topic, if it's focused and guided, I think in a thoughtful way, you actually can get more reflective because the stakes aren't high at that moment. Now you've got an institution you've got to care for, but if you can suspend the stakes for a moment and just talk about it in some of the ways that we've been talking about, I think boards and presidents can get there. And that's the key to the fundraisers getting there, because if the fundraisers feel pressure, they're going to respond to that. I think the key might go back, or does go back, to something that Rebecca said earlier about the moment we're in terms of organizations thinking about their future and their willingness to understand that philanthropy is not possessed, and that we get into that mindset that philanthropy or donors are ours. When we are in the mode of institution maintenance, when we're worried about the institutional success and survival. But the transition that we want, I think, boards and presidents to make is to begin thinking of themselves as stewards of the mission, along with being stewards of the institution, but primarily stewards of the mission. And that might open up newer conversations about how do we preserve and advance this mission. And when you're talking about philanthropy at the deepest and highest levels, you're really talking about the union of mission and values, and how do you connect a donor's values with the mission. And a donor, a donor knows it. If you're coming at them with a institutional question, they can sense it. They still might want to help, but you come at them with a mission question, I think you've got the beginnings of a really rich conversation.
Yeah, one of the fun things when I get the opportunity to work with a board that's dwelling a little bit in a retreat or something, is, and they're thinking about fundraising, and often it's as they're thinking about launching a campaign or something and looking at really big gifts. And to have them tell stories of what has been the best gift you have ever made in your life. And maybe that gave you the greatest joy. Describe it and tell us why. And then what has been the most life-giving thank you that you've ever gotten? Mm-hmm. And as they begin to tell their stories and then say, what are some of the themes we're beginning to hear? Then how do we take what you've just said about what you want? And if the goal is to do unto others, as I would have done unto me, what do we take from what we've just learned and apply that to our fundraising program? And then how can you remind yourselves, if in a board meeting you hear yourselves falling back into the old mode of we've just got to get out there and grab somebody by the neck and shake the money out of their pockets, kind of thing, to go, what did we say? What did we learn from our conversations? And you do kind of see a light bulb go on. And particularly, it's really fun if that can come right after some of those, what I call almost obnoxious conversations. And then it's like, oh my goodness, what were we just saying? I wouldn't want to be treated like that. And so they're there telling their own stories. And it's also really, from a fundraiser's point of view, I love hearing people say, what was the best thank you I ever got? And it's always, always, always more of the story. They came back with more of the story so that I could see where my gift moved the story forward. I don't want another plaque. I don't want another keychain. I don't even need my name on your wall. I just want to know more of the story. And keep coming back, because this story is going to go on for a very long time.
You know,
so just keep coming back.
You know, Jason and Rebecca, this conversation has caused me to rethink my article and to reframe it. Both. So when I think about, you know, my three points, renewal, re-engagement, and raising the bar, I think I would say that what I've learned in this conversation is that this is a time of renewal, but the renewal of the persons that are involved in these relationships and re-engagement is re-engagement with the relationship itself, and raising the bar is raising our expectations, both of ourselves as solicitors, as presidents, as board members, but also as donors and givers as well. So renewal, re-engagement, and raising the bar really take on deeper and more meaningful context now, thanks to this conversation.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to be thinking, even in my own work at my congregation, where we're thinking about as the congregation, in a sense, is coming back. And, you know, it's easy to get up there and start singing the old woe is us, and it's been a long, long, sad year, and so get out your wallets and instead of, you know, re-engaging, renewing, and taking the time to really raise the bar in appropriate ways. Mm-hmm. So I like it.
Yeah, I suspect a lot of my listeners are going to be eager to perhaps reach out to one or both of you. David, we'll start with you. If somebody's listening to our conversation, tell us who it is you want to hear from. Who is that ideal person you want to hear from? Rebecca, I'm going to ask you the same question so you can simmer on this as well. Who is it you want to hear from, David? And then how do they find you? Send us to a website. We'll obviously put your information in the show notes in terms of LinkedIn. But who is that person, David, you want to hear from after today's conversation?
I think presidents and CEOs who are interested in having a deeper appreciation for this enormous role that development and fundraising plays in their job descriptions, but may not have that experience in that experience set. Most college presidents are experts in something else other than fundraising. Yes. But fundraising is something that you have to develop some strength in. So you can reach me at thedevelopmentpresident.com.
David, that's great. And we'll put that information in the show notes. Rebecca, I ask you the same question. Who's the person you want to hear from and where do they find you?
Yeah, I love working with boards, but it's hard for a board to reach out to me. But yeah. I think, well, it shows up in my strength finder. I am an encourager. And so I would love to hear from a weary fundraiser who just needs somebody to say, you can do it. I promise this will work if you try. If you need, I'll talk to your CEO. But sometimes we just need somebody to talk to and somebody who can cheer them on. So I guess since I probably can't get whole boards reaching out to me. I'm here for you fundraisers. I feel your pain. I know it. It's probably because where I'm at in my career and my work, I just recently took down my website, so they can't find me there. But on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way to reach me through my LinkedIn profile.
It has certainly been a pleasure. You are both always welcome back. I admire and appreciate my friendships with both of you. Listening to both of you sort of conclude your thoughts and describe who you want to hear from, it occurs to me you ought to, probably the two of you ought to do a little more collaboration, because it sounds like you could pair up and do some pretty difficult but very meaningful work together. It's certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back.
Thank you
so much, Jason. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, David.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.